On February 18, 1952, four Coast Guardsmen set out from Station Chatham in a 36-foot lifeboat to locate the mortally wounded tanker Pendleton and rescue its crew during a nor'easter. All four men knew the odds of finding the Pendleton and surviving the storm were slim. Their story is chronicled in the book The Pendleton Disaster off Cape Cod, the greatest small boat rescue in Coast Guard history. And joining us is the author of the book, Teresa Mitchell Barba. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for the opportunity to be here again.
Sure. Now, you first met these four crewmen in 2002 at a reunion in Boston, and they had not seen each other right in many, many years. And the Pendleton mission was something they didn't talk about.
Correct. They didn't speak about it to one another, and they did not talk about it in their lives, not very much. Depends on which gentleman you're talking about. But the Coast Guard, specifically, it was Captain Russell Webster, who was then Chief of Operations for District 1. He actually wrote a couple of chapters in the book to complement my work, and he also composed the foreword. He's very history-minded, former Coast Guard officer, and said, gosh, it would be great to bring these guys together after 50 years. And in May of 2002, they were all brought by the Coast Guard to Boston, the first part of the three-day reunion.
And that was, they were reluctant. Well, Bernie Weber, at least, was reluctant to attend this reunion.
He was, because he did not, he was a little concerned, very concerned about meeting up with the media again, and there was a lot of baggage from this 1952 rescue that he had to deal with, and he didn't want to go through it again.
Before we get into the whole story, so you meet them at this reunion. Were you there? At that point, had you decided you were going to write a book on this, or
no.
Why were you there?
I was there because I did a lot of work and still do a lot of work in cultural and maritime history. I founded the something called the annual Cape Cod Maritime History Symposium, at which the 36500 was the topic of a lecture. And Captain Webster, who was then based sector chief in Woods Hole, came to hear the lecture. So I met him there. Mm-hmm. And he, we got to correspond about our history work. And he mentioned about the reunion. And I said, gosh, if you need help, let me know.
Let me know. So how did this become a book then? What happened? You got there? You
A few days them? After the reunion, well, I had intended to interview them all, maybe to write an article or just to have the information to archive it somewhere. And then by, you know, the time everyone arrived and we were all meeting and going out to dinner and attending a Coast Guard luncheon at the base in Boston, I thought, gosh, this would make a great book. So I interviewed all four fellas and started working on it.
Yeah. Now, United States Life-Saving Service preceded the Coast Guard. And you talk a little bit about the history. This isn't just about the Pendleton. You talk a little bit about the history of the Coast Guard. So I think anybody with any interest in the Coast Guard would love to even, you know, some of that information that's in there. But a lot of people didn't know, I don't think know that. It was the United States Life-Saving Service. Tell us about that, how that came about.
That came about because the Humane Society of Massachusetts felt mariners were in distress. And if a boat would crash onto the shoals or a little offshore, there was no way to rescue them. So the life-saving service was born out of that. And then the life-saving service merged with the revenue cutter service. And then around 1915, the Coast Guard was born.
Yeah. Now, February 18th, 1952, there was a nor'easter which produced 70 knot winds and 60-foot seas. Just the thought of 60-foot seas, I just can't even
further
imagine.
Further out. Of course, not right on shore, but further out.
Now, that snapped two 503-foot tankers, the SS Fort Mercer and the SS Pendleton. Tell us about the tankers and their locations. We knew about, I guess they knew about the Mercer. They had not really realized the Pendleton at this point had split in two as well.
The Mercer was able to get a SOS off before the radio went black. And so the Coast Guard knew about the Mercer, which was northeast of the Pendleton and northeast of Cape Cod. And they were able to, they sent a plane out to kind of spot it. The plane accidentally found the Pendleton at that point, whose radio did not work.
Right.
And then the Coast Guard realized, oh my gosh, we've got two tankers. And 503 feet, the kerosene shifted, the tanker shifted, and it just snapped in two. And I'm not sure that could happen today, but it was a single-hulled tanker.
Right, right. And so the Coast Guard, they've got their rescue effort going for the Mercer when they realize now they've got the Pendleton. Now, bring us to Bernie Weber. Bernie Weber is now ordered to put together a crew to rescue the Pendleton.
Yes, exactly. He had been out. Remember, he had been out with all the other Coasties earlier all day, getting boats that had flown off their mooring, you know, pulling them back to shore, out in the elements all day. So about 5:30, 6 o'clock, the bosun, fellow in charge of the station, said, Bernie, get yourself a crew and get out there and go rescue the guys at the Pendleton. Today, I'm not sure that the Coast Guard would have sent out a crew in that. But this was 1952 when the motto was, you have to go out. You don't necessarily have to come back in.
Right.
So he looked around, and Irvin Maskey, who was actually awaiting transit to back to a lightship, who was not officially part of the Station Chatham crew, was volunteered, you know, I'll go out with you. Mm-hmm. So that was great. That was one. Andy Fitzgerald, who was the second engineer on duty, the first one, I believe, was ill. Mm-hmm. He went out, and Richard Livesey was a surfman, so he went as well, and Bernie.
Yeah. Now tell us about the boat they were in. This was not, we're talking about 503-foot tankers, but this boat was what, 36 feet?
36 feet with a very small engine, the engine of the day, not a powerful one, and with a maximum safety rating of 11.
Mm.
And nowadays, of course, 36 feet was standard back then. And as soon as they left Chatham Harbor, the windshield blew in, the compass tore off its mount, was lost. All they had was a little spotlight, about the power of on a police car today.
Right.
I mean, that's what they had, you know, those little ones.
And they're out in this wild weather, this wild seas. And they themselves weren't so sure they were going to be coming back from this mission. They thought that they were probably going to die.
Oh, they thought it was a suicide mission, for sure.
Yeah. We're talking with Teresa Mitchell-Barbeau. Her book is The Pendleton Disaster off Cape Cod. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to join our conversation or if you have a question, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. All right, so let's set the scene here. We've got Bernie strapped into his seat. They couldn't hear each other. They were relying on hand signals to communicate. And again, I guess that visual of you've got this 36 boat, you've got this 503-foot tanker.
Split in two.
Yeah, and these guys are climbing down a ladder trying, and you've got to, they can't just drive right up and go, everybody get on board.
No,
they're making several passes. And
they make one pass for every person, and the Jacob's ladder, and you're talking probably maybe four stories high. This was not just an even deck situation. This was a super tanker of the day and a little tiny boat.
Right.
And Bernie had to come up against the ship, even with the ship. And then the fellows would jump from the ladder onto the deck, and Richard and Irvin would be scooping them up and throwing them, you know, first in that safety compartment for 11 and all over the little tiny vessel.
Right. There's one guy, tiny, who they're trying to save. And he doesn't make it.
He does not make it. He is an able seaman, also was alleged to have done some cooking on the ship. 300 pounds, came out, was not last to get out, but was maybe 9 or 10, right in the middle of those being rescued, and jumped and missed, and Irvin tried to pull him up. And by then, the wave, he was in between the 36500 and the Pendleton and was crushed.
You have a little section of the book you want to read about that. This was something when you think about this, I mean, here's this guy holding on to him for dear life, and he's holding on to the, you know, the guy in the boat. And this really haunted all of the crewmen many, many years later. And maybe you can read just a little bit of that.
I shall. The fellow that died has never left Andy. I see him lots of times in the water, Fitzgerald recalled 50 years later. And even though this is 57 years later, back in 2002. We couldn't help him, and he couldn't help himself, added Bernie. Richard and Irvin rushed to help Andy with Tiny before Myers let go. It looked to me like he'd just fallen into the water off the ladder coming from the ship, and we reached down to grab him. All the other guys seemed like we could get him, pull him back quick, but Tiny we couldn't, remembered Richard. I had a hold on him, but I couldn't hold on to him, Irvin said. I see his eyes looking right at me, Bernie recounted. I could look at you, and I could see his eyes. And actually, the message I was getting was, it's okay. Somehow or other, I got that.
Now, just as they got the last crewman off the Pendleton, it went under. How ironic. Yeah, I mean, that time was of the essence. And we had, 35? How many survivors were there that got into the boat? I think it was 30-something anyway.
32 who got in the boat.
Okay, and this is a boat, and remember, we said for 11 people.
Right.
So you've got them crammed in.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Yeah. And again, as mentioned, you know, Bernie's tied in. And it's not an easy job, you know, when you're thinking, he's got himself tied into the seat to be able to not be falling out of his seat. But driving this boat was not an easy task in those conditions.
No, it wasn't. And it wasn't easy. Even if it were a flat, calm sea, you had to work the throttle. You had to steer. You had to, I don't know the exact mechanics of the day, but it was pretty rough for him.
Right. Now, let me ask you, too, this. We mentioned when they were ordered to go out there, the bosun said, head out. And as Bernie and the crew are going out, they say, all right, we're radioing in. And they're thinking they're going to be called back again, but they didn't. They said, keep going. So at this point, they're going, as I mentioned, a suicide mission. And they couldn't believe they were being sent out there. But what bravery when you think about that here are and these are young guys. These were, early 20s?
Yeah.
Thereabouts. Yeah. These guys have this, they're looking ahead going, we're not going to make this, but they go anyway. They do their job. And how brave they were.
Quite brave. And when they were out to sea, Bernie radioed to Chatham, we have them all. We're on our way in. And then the arguing began.
Right. And this is another interesting point. You want to read about that.
There was a vacuum of leadership, and the officers who were also at sea aboard larger cutters said, bring them to us. And he says, I can't do that. Bernie was upset that there was the questioning who had more say, seniority among the cutters offshore, as to how and what decisions were being made. Everyone can hear you on that one channel you're on, said Irvin, who stood at Bernie's side when all this was going on. They wanted me to bring the survivors out to the larger ships, bring them out to us. Well, my first question is, where are you? Said Bernie. And if you know where you are, tell me where I am, because I don't know where I am. So the idea of bringing the survivors out to the larger Coast Guard cutter didn't make any sense, especially because I had just gotten them off a ship that was bigger than most of the Coast Guard cutters. And I knew that I knew what it took to get them off, and I couldn't imagine what it would be like to try to put them on another ship out there in those conditions, so I disregarded what they had to say. Exhausted, freezing, and now irritated, Bernie remembered, I hear all this crap going on, and I shut the radio off, he remembered. I shut off the radio so as not to be placed in the position of being directed to do what I knew was a bad decision on their part. Later, Bosun Clough informed Weber that disciplinary action was a possibility, along with a court-martial, because there were some ranking officers who didn't take kindly to the fact that I had turned off my radio and just made my decisions as to what our actions and fate would be, he clarified. And so he told the guys, we'll probably hit the beach somewhere. I hope it's Monomoy, but if it isn't Monomoy and I miss it altogether, we're going to wind up in Nantucket Sound. And good Lord, we've got all the options in the world. If we have to go all the way to Nobscot Point before we hit something, my attitude was just fine land. I'll hold it on the beach with the engine and get off as quick as you can. Don't ask questions. Get off and hope somebody finds you.
Oh. Let's talk to Susan, who's giving us a call from Orleans. Hi, Susan.
It's Suzanne.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi.
You have a comment or question?
Is this Mindy Todd?
Yes, it is.
Hi. We've got the 36500 in our boat building shop right now, and I'm staring at it.
Wow.
I'm listening to the interview, and I'm thinking the it's such a terrific story, and it's such a big piece of history, and here it is in Orleans.
Yeah, and now when you look at that, imagine this, the crew of four fitting another 32 survivors in that boat.
Oh, yeah. No, we do every day.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah, imagine.
And I've asked everybody who works on it to read both books. There are two books written about the Pendleton. Yeah. But the other thing that might be mentioned is that it's in dire need of funding because we've still got a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
And the Orleans Historical Society has done a lot to raise as much money as they can, but with the economy being what it is,
right,
it's been a struggle.
Yeah. Well, Suzanne, thanks for calling and sharing that with us. We appreciate your phone call. And if you would like to chime in with a comment or a question, our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. Okay. Now, as they came in to Chatham, the fish pier was packed with people who came to help. And I have to say, I actually got a little teary reading that part because this was, I mean, these were not just Coast Guard. These were people from the town. These were fishermen and just townspeople, and they all rushed down there to see if they could help.
Chatham was then a wonderful fishing village, still is. And word got around. A lot of folks had, the radios, the marine radios, and they were aware of what was going on. They were coming in. They rushed down with blankets and soup and all this. And then all the survivors were brought to Station Chatham, many of whom after a while collapsed because probably the adrenaline wore out and they were freezing. And then they were transported to what is now Cape Cod Hospital, where a nurse said to them, tear open down pillows and stick their feet and hands in them. That'll warm them up.
Yeah. She was clever, wasn't she?
Very clever. Yeah.
Now, of course, here's Bernie, who is exhausted. And finally, there was a radio reporter there, and they did some interviews. And they all look so happy in the photos that you have there. But you can just imagine how exhausted they must have been. So Bernie goes to sleep. And he wakes up the next morning at Station Chatham, and he found that a lot of the survivors had placed money around him. I guess so, in gratitude.
So what he did was he gave the money to the station chief, and I think they bought a television for the station.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, weather certainly played a part in this crash, but what was the official cause? What was the word on why these tankers?
The contents shifted, and that kerosene oil is very heavy, and it just, a large part was in the bow, a large part was in the stern, the compartments, and just snapped in two.
Yeah. How odd that you would have two of them on the same night.
Well, they were identical tankers in identical weather conditions, but you're right. I mean, the odds of that happening are...
So tell us what happened in the Fort Mercer. Were there many survivors there?
There were survivors at the Fort Mercer. Both vessels did suffer casualties.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk a little bit about Bernie's history, because you talk about that in the book. He was, as a young man, got into a bit of trouble, I guess, with his parents.
He really didn't. Well, he was the youngest of four boys, and he just couldn't find his way. And they sent him to a prep school.
Right.
And
wasn't him.
It wasn't him. So he kind of
took off with a friend
and came home through the cornfields and just said, look, I'm home again. And
so his dad, not knowing what to do with
his
him.
His dad was a minister, and all of his three older sons were in World War II, and they were gone. And in 1946, Bernie, at the age of 17, begged to be, I have to do something else. So he went in the Merchant Marine Service for a couple of years. And then he went down to Commercial Wharf in Boston to re-up for the Merchant Marine Service, and the office was closed. And he kind of turned his head and saw a Coast Guard recruiting office. And he went in, and the guy said, what do you want? He goes, I want to, the Coast Guard, I want to sign up. He goes, well, what do you have to offer the Coast Guard? He goes, I'm a merchant seaman. And the guy immediately took his feet off the table and sat up and
had a change of attitude.
Change of attitude. So he was in the Coast Guard for 66 years.
Yeah, wow.
I do want to also note that the book, The Pendleton Disaster, mm-hmm. is on the Commandant's recommended reading list for leadership. Mm-hmm. And all the proceeds, the author proceeds from this book, are going to a scholarship fund at the Coast Guard Academy.
Oh, that's great. We should also mention
very
Bernie,
sad news.
Yeah, Bernie passed away this past weekend.
He passed away Saturday night of a heart attack at his home in Melbourne, Florida. His wife of 59 years, Miriam, was by his side. Mm-hmm. So he was not alone. And thank the Lord he was not driving a car or anything. He was home. Yeah. Suffered a heart attack.
And he met Miriam when he was stationed in Chatham.
He did. He did. You've got a great memory.
Yeah. I read the book.
You read the book, yeah. And in Wellfleet, where they met.
Yeah.
And that's where he will be buried later. Yeah.
Now, you talk a little bit, and a lot of it focuses on Bernie, but you also talk about the other guys in here. That's one of the things I think, and you bring out that Bernie was upset with in the 1950s, when all the media attention after and so much focused on him, and obviously he didn't do this alone.
He didn't do it alone, and they wanted to award him the gold life-saving medal, and they were going to give Ernie, Richard, and Andy the silver, and he goes, no, I don't want a medal unless they get the gold too. So he always, even at the age of 23, exhibited this leadership, and he was feted all over. I mean, he was the subject of many awards and things like that, but he just wanted to be in the Coast Guard, and he felt there was resentment by enlisted and officers thinking he was this great hero, that he made a lot of money off of this, and he didn't.
He did not. He was a hero, though.
He was a hero, but the best heroes are the ones who are quiet about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me ask you about the process in writing this book. And you write a lot of maritime history. Tell us about the process.
Well, there's several stages coming up with what Aristotle said. Part of rhetoric is finding something to write about, the five parts of rhetorical theory. And you kind of have to hone that idea and be very specific about what you want to write about and use deduction to get your research in order. Research can be easy. You know, I love the interviews. I like going back and forth. But compiling it is always a challenge, for me at least. But the actual composition, you know, writing is just a scribal act. We both have papers here and pens and
pencils.
Pencils, and that's what writing is. When you write, you know, literature, or when you write nonfiction or fiction, you're composing in the same way a musician or a composer composes music. So you have to really do it right. You have to become very friendly with solitude. When you came in this morning, you said hi to coworkers. You know, maybe took a few phone calls. You know, sharing coffee with someone for a few minutes on a break. You don't have that as a writer. You are a team of one. And by the very nature of what you need to do, your goal, you have to be alone. So you have to be, as a consistent writer, for me, it's not lonely, but I am isolated. And that's tough sometimes. I've got my two Labradors looking at me.
Yeah, and you can't run it by them. How does this sound?
I know. You can't do that. Yeah, you can't do that. Yeah. And so the book is the book is human interest. Mm-hmm. You know, the book is telling the human side of the story. There is a mention of the 36500 website, which is in the book. This book is not about the boat itself or what happened to the boat or its restoration. This book is about what happened that night in 1952.
All right. Let me ask you about Captain Webster, because he, as you mentioned, he wrote some of this as well. Was he helpful in the research part of it? Did he help you with that at all?
Yeah, he was helpful in a number of ways. When I came across, you know, an acronym I didn't know for the Coast Guard or I remember he sent me a Coast Guard manual. Really, that helped because it proved a seminal core resource. And I asked him to compose the foreword, and he wrote a chapter about the significance of the gold life-saving medal. And he composed another chapter about some current Coast Guard issues, right, which were very helpful to the story.
Let me ask you about, for Captain Webster, Bernie and the crew were heroes, and he certainly realized the importance of this mission. And it seemed to be the younger Coast Guardsmen, when Bernie and the other guys were here in 2002, they seemed to get it as well. I mean, he was.
They do.
And tell
they
us about the, there was a meeting or something, and all the high ranking guys left, and it was just Bernie and
sure
and the guys.
Bernie, one of the, I don't want to say conditions, but one of the things that Bernie said was, "Look, I'll do this, but I want to spend a little time alone with the enlisted guys." Pardon me. So he was able to do that. He, after the public festivities were over, they went into the mess hall, and all the officers were asked to leave. You had a couple of captains and a few other folks all asked to leave. It was just Bernie and anyone who was a non-commissioned officer. And he talked to them. He took questions, and they really were able to have a great discussion, which bridged the generations. And here you have Bernie, who, you know, one of his first missions, one of his first duties was to work with one of the last of the lifesavers.
Right.
And he really was this living bridge between, you know, the Coast Guard of yesteryear and today. And he also went to the Coast Guard Academy 2 summers ago and talked to to the cadets there.
Yeah. I bet the captains were wishing they could be in that, you know,
yeah,
hearing his words.
I could still see them sitting there with, like, twiddling their thumbs, like, oh, I wish I were
in
there.
I could hear. I'd be a fly on the wall.
Yeah.
Now, I mentioned earlier that Bernie was reluctant to come and attend this reunion in 2002. He was happy he did, though, in the end.
He was. I think it healed a few wounds. Yes, mm-hmm. He was.
Yeah. And what about the rest of the guys?
Irvin Maskey, which broke my heart. I think we have a few minutes left.
About a minute.
Okay. Yeah. Irvin Maskey, at the end of, they were ready to get in a Coast Guard van and go back to Boston, back to their lives. And Irvin was alone. Everyone was getting things ready. And I walked over to him. I go, oh, Irvin, it was so nice to meet you. And we had this time together. And he says, you know, he had a very strong Midwestern accent. You know, none of the guys in the garage where I worked in Wisconsin believed me when I said I was on this mission, and now maybe they'll believe me.
Mm.
And it brought tears to my eyes. And he died in October of 2003. He was driving a bus, and he had a heart attack. But no children were aboard the bus. It was empty.
And the other two?
Richard Livesey passed on in 2007. In December of 2007, and Andy Fitzgerald is still alive and living in Colorado.
All right. Thanks so much. The book is The Pendleton Disaster off Cape Cod, The Greatest Small Boat Rescue in Coast Guard History. Teresa Mitchell-Barbo is the author. Thanks again, Teresa.
Oh, thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is hosted and produced by Mindy Todd. The executive producer is Steve Young. Production assistance from Dan Treidel and Jenny Jenker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.